Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today. First, in a few minutes, Mark Fisher will talk to us about Russell Brand, working class agency, and capitalist realism. And then George Shalaba, a writer whose collection of essays For the Republic was published a few months ago, will talk about democracy, plutocracy, and why not to despair. First up, Mark Fisher. A few weeks ago, the actor Russell Brand, someone I find incredibly smart, witty, and appealing, appeared on the BBC's Newsnight program and gave its host, the smug Jeremy Paxman, a rude talking to about politics. I thought it was a remarkable performance, but it prompted a firestorm of denunciations, many of them coming from rather posh people, of Brand's alleged sexism, a story based in part on inventions by the Murdoch press, and his privilege. Criticism prompted an excellent essay by my first guest, Mark Fisher, called Exiting the Vampire Castle, published on the North Star website. Google Mark Fisher, vampire, and you'll find it right away. I found it an excellent diagnosis of the state of left politics today, including the very Twitterish habit of calling people out for their shortcomings. Fisher is also the author of a fine little book called Capitalist Realism from Zero Books. Mark Fisher. Welcome, Mark. Russell Brand has set off a bit of a fever on British TV and circulated around the world. I thought he was rather inspiring and moving, his fight with the TV hack Jeremy Paxman. But he got a lot of criticism for being an elitist, for being rich, for being, you know, the white guy. What do you make, first of all, of Brand's appearance on TV?
Well, I mean, I have to say that I was absolutely moved by it. I thought it was one of the most striking things I've seen for many years. And that was largely to do with a form of class insubordination, really. But, you know, what was being played out almost to an exaggerated degree was, a kind of class conflict. Paxman almost pathologically relaxed with that, you know, that ruling class air of absolutely being at home in the world. Brand, on the other hand, presenting a kind of working class intelligence that just hasn't had the space in mainstream media for a very long time, you know, struck me as kind of a major moment in, you know, widening the bandwidth of mainstream media. But also, yes, there's this form of insubordination, which is not about Brand sort of maintaining the sort of stereotype of kind of working class antagonism that we saw even in famous cases of media class antagonism, such as that, you know, when the Sex Pistols were on TV, they simply swore. What Brand did was outwit Paxman. He outwitted him, and I think that the double sense of the word "wit," as in reason and intelligence on the one hand, and humor on the other hand. He ran rings around him.
He's very smart. He's very funny, and he's very good with words. And he's just a dazzling performance.
Yeah, exactly, and I thought that's what excited me and many others about that, Brand's intervention at that on Newsnight. Sadly, that's not how everyone responded to it. Yes, we saw these kind of fairly predictable criticisms of Brand. You know, everyone should have to answer for their behaviour, for the language that they use. So it's not that I'm saying that, you know, I'm disquiet about Brand's supposed sexism is completely unwarranted. What disturbed me, though, in a lot of the responses to Brand, I think maybe more over here than in the US, I don't know, was from people supposedly on the left, was the way that they allowed Brand's personal conduct, or alleged personal conduct, since many of the accusations about Brand seem to be based on things written in Murdoch tabloids. This became the dominant story, that the story was not about a kind of a major charismatic intervention by a left-wing figure, but it became about, you know, it became about his personal conduct. And there's also just kind of other disturbing responses that, because he's rich, he's not on our side. As if, we're painting ourselves in a corner here with this response, where, you know, anyone who becomes successful, anyone who's in the mainstream media, by definition, can't be speaking for us. And that seems to me a severely problematic position on lots of levels, really.
Yeah, I saw a presentation by Gayatri Spivak at a monument to Gramsci that was built in a New York City public housing development. At one point she said, people say, you're privileged. He said, yeah, damn right I'm using my privilege. And in that case, you know, Brand privileged, but he is using his privilege. He's using access to the media that most people don't have.
Yeah, I think Spivak's response is exactly right. We want to be in a position. We want to be in positions of power and influence. This is what we want. We don't want to be in positions of sort of impotence and marginality. Well, I don't think I want to be in that position anyway. I wouldn't have thought that the left in general ought to want. One of the great things about this, about Brand, was that he was doing something I think we were used to seeing in popular culture and from people from working class backgrounds many years ago, but which we're not accustomed to seeing for some time, which is biting the hand that feeds you. You know, in a sense, the whole outburst of energy around popular music since the 60s was sort of going on into punk, etc., was based on this idea that we shouldn't be grateful. We shouldn't be grateful to the bourgeoisie for giving us resources, space, etc., money, because they've stolen these things from us in the first place. And one of the inspiring things about Brand was that he straight up said that. Paxman's line of questioning, who are you to edit a political magazine? You know, Brand absolutely refused to engage with that on any level, refused to go cap in hand. One of the key lines for me of that exchange, you know, I'm taking it. I don't require the permission of somebody in order to speak. I'm taking this authority. And in conditions really where people from working class backgrounds are sort of have been massively patronized, condescended to, condemned, you know, held up for ridicule, I think particularly on reality TV, this is how we generally see the working class depicted as kind of uneducated, stupid, etc. In conditions where that is, in many ways, the dominant perception of the working class, that was an extremely radical move of Brand to say, I'm taking this position and no one can stop me. The challenge to all of us, though, if he can do that, if he can stand up to Paxman, if he can stand up to the establishment in mainstream media, then why can't we stand up as well?
But then from Brand's performance and the reactions to it, which were remarkable, you spun a tale about a vampire's castle. What is this vampire's castle?
Funny enough, the day before this now momentous interview, I'd seen Brand perform live as a show at the Masai Complex, and I was totally amazed by it. And I'd always liked Brand, but he seemed to have gone on to a new level with this. This was like a 90 minutes of just incredible, witty, left-wing discourse, pro-communist, actually using the term communist positively, anti-homophobic, anti-racist. But I thought twice about posting something up on Facebook about that because I knew that some people would respond in a moralizing way, that they would bring up the sort of accusations of sexism against Brand, et cetera, et cetera. I thought twice about it, but I went ahead and did it. And what duly happened was, you know, some of those people that expected to attack it took it that way. Rather than what I normally do, which is often on social media, try and avoid these disputes because they largely go nowhere, and also out of fear, really, because, you know, there's this McCarthyite sort of logic of smearing whereby if someone like Brand is accused of sexism, if you in any way defend Brand, not for those things which he's accused of being sexist, but for anything, then you also get by this kind of bizarre chain of equivalence. You know, if Brand is a sexist, well, he's not only a sexist, if he's a sexist, he's a misogynist. And if you in any way defend Brand, then you must also be a sexist or a misogynist. That duly happened, you know, within minutes of me mounting a defense of Brand, which was not saying, well, he must be defended on everything that he said, but that, you know, how do we move forward? If we think Brand's sexist, what do you do? Do we sort of publicly castigate him? Do we set up kangaroo courts in the media? Do we condemn him from above? Or do we try, you know, do we try to enter into dialogue with somebody, move forward in solidarity, et cetera, et cetera? And really from that, spun out my sort of fear and issues with the set of discourses which led to this kind of individualizing condemnation of Brand, which of course is not unique. I mean, we've seen this year, particularly in the UK, a sort of number of like Twitter storms, vicious infighting, savage condemnations of people. They don't just come from nowhere. They're not just sort of individual moral failings. They come out of a certain kind of what I call libidinal discursive formation. And that's what I meant by the term vampire's castle. It's one another word for it would be liberal Stalinism, I think.
What produces this? I mean, is this something that the social media, the forms of the social media themselves encourage or produce, or is this present in the larger society and just gets reflected there?
David Blacker, I think, in discussing my article on Van Pascastle, described it very well when he talked about a certain form of organisation of misery that occurred, and particularly in universities, I think. I mean, a lot of people who've attacked the piece talk of this, the kind of discourses I'm trying to delineate, you know, have their origins in some kind of street struggle, etc. But that's just, I just don't see it that way at all. I think that what I mean by Vampire's Castle is really a certain set of discourses that have their origins in the university, and I think probably particularly the US university system. But a certain form of identitarianism, not a term I invented myself, but which I think has, you know, a special currency at the moment. And you know, this form of identitarianism essentially operates by individualizing and privatizing everything. Although if you ask the people involved in this, they have a notional commitment to the idea of kind of structural causation, you know, that racism and sexism are caused structurally. But in actual practice, what they'll always end up doing is focusing on individuals. And there's a synergy between this kind of identitarianism and social media, which has produced the current kind of, for me, horrific kind of situation, that the social media allows this kind of swarming of individuals to kind of reach a new level. And also, a part of the issue is that this kind of liberal identitarianism, and for me, identitarianism is essentially liberal, has managed to, you know, inveigle itself into every corner of the left now.
A lot of people might be listening and saying, well, this is just two straight white guys complaining about things.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough, and we should always be mindful of things that coming from that position. But I think what we've also got to say is, where are these discourses coming from? That's part of the kind of mendacity that's involved here. These discourses are not coming off the street. They're not coming directly from marginalized groups. They're coming from a way of organizing or apprehending those kind of minorities, which is also from a very elite position, I think. It's a disguised form of elitism. But who talks that way except for people who've come into contact with universities? You know, these discourses are very academic. This, the way of speaking, a certain form of kind of piety. This has no traction beyond those who are in who have had contact with the university system. And it's that I object to, really. It's this appropriation of struggles, of forms of suffering, of justice claims. This appropriation of those by a certain form of elitist university discourse, which furthermore I think is counterproductive. I think part of the issue here is, yeah, okay, well, it's ours now, straight white guys talking, but these discourses do little to further the causes that they claim to further. And in fact, in lots of ways, because they're forms of petty bourgeois moralism, I think ultimately, they ultimately serve to turn the wider population, particularly a working class population, away from these struggles. This is a sad post by a friend of mine, working class American woman, who said she completely put off feminism, for instance, by a lot of these discourses. I mean, I think that's tragic, but I think it is inevitable if feminism becomes associated with this kind of petty bourgeois moralism, as it is, I think, in the eyes of many people outside universities. You know, but of course that will that's catastrophic. And, you know, so partly what I want to do with this piece is start to try and establish a difference between, struggles against racism, between feminism as kind of collective practices and the appropriation of those struggles by an ultimately liberal kind of bourgeois academy, really.
I'm speaking with the writer Mark Fisher, author of the essay Exiting the Vampire Castle and the book Capitalist Realism. All this is happening against a broad psycho-political backdrop of what you call capitalist realism. The sense, really, that nothing can ever change. There's a fatalism and a depression underlying a lot of this, what you call moralism. We'll talk about this capitalist realism and this sense of... what I thought was particularly interesting in your book was this depressive affect of so many young people. What's that all about?
Yeah, well, I think actually the dominant affective kind of atmosphere of the current moment is hedonic depression. Actually, nothing sums this up more than records by Drake or Kanye West. You know, that I think Drake is probably best for this. Someone whose records are full of this sense of you know, he can enjoy any pleasure that he wants to. He's got unlimited amounts of money. Yeah, he's still this terrible sadness which he can't rid himself of. If someone who's really got almost everything that this society has to offer is still unhappy, that tells us a story about the current moment, I think, a very strong one. And the point about depression is partly, you know, just a response to just the statistical increase of depression, and particularly that amongst young people. And, you know, I think there's a clear relationship between the sort of rise of depression on the one hand and the kind of, you know, incessant demands for cheery positivity, for what the radical psychotherapist David Smale calls, you know, magical voluntarism, as the kind of dominant ideology, really, of reality TV, where the power to remake ourselves is within us if only we can find it. Of course, that's not true, and of course, then it's very depressing. It's also a related phenomenon is what I call privatization of stress, then. If we're depressed because we haven't got any work, because of course increasing amounts of young people around the world don't have it. If we're depressed because we're at work and our work, we've been asked to do a lot more work for the same money, that's our fault. It's not about, you know, it's not a political problem, because and really this is the meaning of capitalist realism, I think, or one way of looking at it, because politics has disappeared. That's what we could say capitalist realism is. That politics, political struggle, agency have disappeared for the subordinate groups in the society. Of course, politics itself really hasn't disappeared, but it just feels that way because there's only one kind of politics now, and that is, you know, the politics of the capitalist ruling class, who've managed to naturalize their ideology. Capitalist ideology, neoliberal ideology, is no longer perceived as such. Because since there's no effective opposition to it, then it just becomes a kind of quasi-natural horizon of thinkability.
Neoliberalism is so successful at creating us as atomized individuals that we think that any kind of collective ambitious political action is impossible, but also that any discontent with the system is experienced individually, psychologically, as depression, but also any critique of it then becomes very hyper-individualized in this kind of culture of calling out, that you're just going yes. after a bad guy without looking at structures.
Yeah, and I think the sympathetic reading of this call-out culture is that it is a response to a kind of desperate response to this overall sense of helplessness, hopelessness, this overall fatalism. You know, structures are, you know, if we can't get at structures, then it seems that we can get at individuals. But a lot of the popularity of kind of anarchist thought comes from similar roots, really. It seems easier to kind of withdraw from the system, to kind of take control of our own lives, to build up enclaves, than it is to change systems, change kind of hegemony, ultimately. But that's an illusion. It's an illusion. And I think that illusion has been exposed time and time again with the anti-capitalist movement, really. You can't take direct action against capitalism, not in a way that's going to last. What has become clear, I think, over the last few years is what we need is indirect action, not direct action, actually. Changing the ideology of the society in which we live, changing the discursive conditions of the society in which we live, you know, changing the kind of practices, languages, etc., that we're required to use at work. All of those things are the only way to ultimately change things. It seems a bigger ask. It seems a lot harder to try and change those things. But it's simply the case that know, if we believe what we ourselves are saying, that it is, that the things are about structures and they're not about individuals, then, you know, that we have to act on that basis.
Well, how do we do this? I mean, how do we slay the vampire and break out of his castle?
Well, I mean, I think the thing about the vampires is in a way, the reason I wrote that was really as permission to us, I would say, people who identify themselves as communists, socialists, and social democrats, permission to disengage from kind of liberals and from what I call neo-anarchists, really. So I think we take anarchism far too seriously. There's a sleight of hand in anarchist reason that's often employed, which is that they'll judge, you know, social democracy or communism or whatever by what it's actually historically achieved, but by anarchism by what it would achieve in its ideal society. And, you know, like I think we should look at the meager actual historical achievements of anarchism, and also the meager achievements ultimately of the anti-capitalist movement. And we look back at what, you know, effective alliances between communists, socialists, social democrats, you know, achieved in the 20th century, which was an awful lot in my view. It's important to say here that in saying this, I'm not saying we should in any way forget about struggles against racism, sexism or homophobia. I also think they're better delivered in a framework that has got rid of liberalism and what I call neo-anarchism. But ultimately, of course, we don't want to be debating with the vampires. We don't want to be debating with the liberals. We want to reach the wider population. And that's part of the significance of why this brand thing is important, to go back to that he is capable of doing that. And we need more people capable of doing that. We need to be doing it. And, you know, that has to be the project. I mean, my view really is that since the attraction is so low with a wider population, that they only affect those people who already identify as left-wing. And insofar as they affect anybody else, largely it's to put people off becoming involved in politics or left-wing politics. I think, you know, that it's really then that this disengagement from those discourses is the first step towards, you know, trying to actually activate a population. Because, you know, this is, you know, if you talk about what is capitalist realism, it's a depoliticized working class. It's a working class who no longer see that politics is for them. And we have to get real about this. You know, that, of course, this is the case. That part of the kind of underlying fantasy of autonomism is this idea that there is a kind of seething collectivity out there, which is just inhibited in some ways by those of us who are involved in mainstream media or trade unions or political parties. Somehow getting involved with these things blocks the seething potentiality towards collectivity, but it just isn't that seething potentiality. It's not that it couldn't be created, but the point is that it has to be created. You know, there are conditions for the collective agency, and they have been effectively, you know, very effectively dismantled, destroyed by neoliberalism. That's what neoliberalism is. That's what capitalist realism is. So, you know, we need to reconstruct them and a multiplicity of means are necessary to do that. It's not enough to go through mainstream political parties. It's not enough to go through mainstream media. It's not enough to go through, you know, grassroots organization. But all of these things together are clearly necessary, I think.
Now, this is a good setup for my final question, which is, how do you imagine mobilizing this kind of collective political action in a society where capitalist realism is the pervasive way of seeing things, where people really do believe there is no alternative, and there is this depressive lack of ambition and any ability to imagine a utopia outside present reality? We can imagine dystopias very easily, horrible dystopias, but we can't imagine anything better.
We sort of live in one, but, you know, because of the amount of the sort of palliatives that are given, the hedonic palliatives that are given, we don't fully recognize that it's dystopian. And also, I think we'll look back on the early 21st century as a miserable period, a sort of miserable period of cultural homogeneity, of kind of, you know, repetition, of political kind of reaction. We'll look back upon that as that. But we can't really see it now, I think, because we're still in it in lots of ways. And also, that is a symptom of depression, is low expectations. you know, and that this depression is widespread. We all suffer from it to some extent. What to do about that? Well, I think things are already changing. I think the brand thing was part of that, and, you know, significant what he was actually saying, not as was heard by some of the people who attacked him, I'm going to lead a revolution, but that this revolution is going to happen. It's going to happen. That's what he said. And, you know, there's a performative dimension to that, which is very exciting, I think, that you know, his saying it in mainstream media already is not exactly creating the conditions, but exacerbating those conditions, which is already there and which he's pointing to. Another thing that's another sort of moment in mainstream media currently is the whole Hunger Games thing. Quite astonishing. When I watched that film, I thought, how could this be allowed? You know, how can this be a sort of open revolutionary propaganda, really, which is what the, you know, particularly the second film, Catching Fire, is. It's astonishing that a film like this could exist, but it's so timely. And part of what, for me, feels, you know, a very exciting moment, and I can't remember a more exciting moment, I think, for some time, where, you know, this sense of a kind of cracking in the mainstream, and that's partly what's exciting about the Hunger Games, because it's about, you know, revolution on reality TV. But of course, these things aren't enough in themselves. It's not enough for things to be happening in mainstream media. There has to be a connection with everyday life, with workplace politics, etc., etc. But, you know, part of the problem with the kind of neo-anarchist thought is that its model is horizontalism and withdrawal from the mainstream media. The idea that somehow the mainstream media is irredeemably corrupt. That's understandable, given you know, the degree of conservatism of mainstream media, the way that mainstream media has become, you know, increasingly dominated by a sort of right wing and corporate agenda over the last 20 years, and perhaps you know, increasingly so over the last 10 years. But, you know, that I think it's still important to remember that, you know, mainstream media is a terrain of struggle. No, it's not fixed. It's not a fixed monolith. And, you know, that set in our society, you know, that sense of what counts as reality is to a large extent determined by mainstream media, which is why we can't simply withdraw from that space and set up enclaves. We need to have the confidence to take on that terrain. And I think someone like Brand is part of taking back space that, you know, once working class people had, or working class movements had, but which has been denied. So we have to take that back. But it also has to be part of this kind of inter-exciting spiral, really, of where people also have to believe they can take control of their own lives at work. A lot of working class kind of organizations are lying dormant. They're not being exterminated. They're just like trade unions in the UK, and are still one of the biggest organisations in the country. But they're lying inert and dormant because the membership don't really believe they can do anything. And this part of the depressive kind of postmodern end of history mentality that we all have to sort of talk ourselves out of, that history isn't just in the past, that the time when people could do things isn't just in the past, that we can now do things. Getting out of this spectatorial mode by, you know, becoming involved with trade unions, trying to have some kind of control over the way our own workplaces are organized. That is clearly just as important as what's going on in mainstream media. And the two, ideally, people becoming involved with the politics of their own workplaces and what's going on in mainstream media should excite one another, should incite one another. And I think, you know, there's absolutely no reason that can't happen again. I think it is happening, and I think it will increasingly happen over the course of the next few months and years, really.
That was Mark Fisher, author of an excellent essay called Exiting the Vampire Castle, published on the North Star website, and of the book Capitalist Realism, published by Zero Books. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Got everything, I got everything. I cannot complain, I cannot. I don't even know how much I really made. I forgot, it's a lot. Never mind what I got. Don't watch that, cause I came up, that's all me. Stay true, that's all me. No help, that's all me. All me for real. Came came up, that's all me. Stay true, that's all me. No help, that's all me. All me for
money
real.
Money on my mind, you should think the same. J's on, pink ring. Dog needs hope, I need quarantine. In the same league, but we don't ball the same. Oh, you want all the fame. I hit it all the time. Since you love me, I said, baby girl, fall in line. Okay, made a million off a dinner fork. Watch me switch it up. Walked in, ill, alert, ill, alert. You need that work, I got that work. Got in my condo. Just bought a shirt that cost a Mercedes Benz car. No.
That was some of Drake's All Me, featuring 2 Chainz, a musical illustration of the depressive hedonia that Mark Fisher was talking about. Next up, George Shalaba. George is a political essayist of the old sort, a non-academic writing for a non-specialized audience with a remarkably humane and generous intelligence. His collection of essays from the last decade or so for The Republic was published in May by Pressed Wafer, a small Brooklyn-based publisher. George Shalaba. You're a practitioner of what is... Not a common art these days. It's kind of independent intellectual writing political essays in small journals. How do you feel being out of time?
Well, the small journals part is not entirely my idea. I'd be happy to enlighten the readers of the New York Review or the New Yorker or the Atlantic if the editors deigned to offer me a venue. But so it's partly the what I have to say limits the size of the audience to marginal publications. Some, maybe like The Nation and Dissent, not so marginal. But it's, you know, like everything, it has its pluses and minuses. The pluses are that when you have a regular slot or a regular beat, you have to satisfy expectations. And if you're relying on it to make a living, then, you know, you have to worry about how it's going to satisfy your readers and your editors and, you know, the people who employ you. Having a day job and having gotten it when I had a rent-controlled apartment, having the apartment go condo at a time just before the Cambridge real estate boom went crazy, having Harvard's workforce go union after I joined it, gave me a certain amount of financial security so I could work part-time. I didn't have to scramble up the ladder and try to become a better paying administrator, which I would have had to take home at night. So I was very lucky. I did what intellectuals often did in the 30s and 40s. That is, I made a living with half my energy and time and had the other half free. I don't know that that's possible for most people without lots of luck nowadays, just because there's no more rent control anywhere, and, you know, unions are dwindling.
And the demands of the job are expanding.
Right. So I feel very lucky. And as for not having a larger audience, you know, you just try and keep the pass the gifts along to however few and hope that one of them will, at some point in the chain of transmission, be able to pass it on to a lot more people than you.
Of course, a lot of intellectual writing these days is done by academics who don't necessarily have a very large audience either. So it's the size of the audience isn't what I'm thinking of. It's more the nature of the audience. You're writing for a much more general literary or political audience and not an audience of hyper-specialization.
Although I don't consciously think about it. I just write for myself, really. You know, I was 40 before I started, and, 35. And I'd been formed, in a way, by Victorian novels and by 20th century and 19th century public intellectuals like Orwell and Russell. So I don't know, it doesn't present itself to me. I don't think about the audience or the occasion. And again, I don't have to, because if this editor says no, then I'll offer it to another, and if at least once you get a certain number of outlets that will at least entertain suggestions from you, you don't feel compelled to, you don't have to worry about even pleasing that editor as much. So, I try to write in a plain style that doesn't require, you know, any theoretical or empirical background. I try to speak to citizens.
Yeah, well, when you speak of citizens, one of your recurring themes is the contradiction between our growing plutocracy and our formal democracy. How do you regard the health of that relation these days?
Well, in this new book, there's an essay in a section by itself called Rant, and it's called Plutocratic Vistas as a kind of sad allusion to Walt Whitman's great essay, Democratic Vistas. It's an inspiring, lyrical pain to the promise of American life, American democracy, as it looked to Whitman to be becoming. And it's that promise has been frustrated, as we all know, by the development of the forms of capitalism that we're critical of, at least you and I and most of your listeners. There was strong in native resistance to it in the forms of populism and the early Socialist Party, and they were defeated, but they were still, their legacy was alive when the Great Depression occurred, and they were alive to the extent that it seemed wise to the ruling class to, you know, make some serious concessions in the form of the New Deal. But of course, they were made under duress, and they were never felt legitimate by the masters of the universe. And there was always an undercurrent, increasingly articulate and organized, of resistance among the business class to the first backlash was in the form of the Taft-Hartley Act. But throughout the 50s, even though mainstream Republicanism professed to accept the New Deal, Eisenhower and even Nixon in the 50s, though they were the business party, they pretty much expected that Social Security, that public education, robustly funded, you know, the safety net was a permanent part of American life and the welfare state. But more visionary reactionaries didn't accept that, and they kept sniping and kept looking for viable candidates of their ilk, tried Goldwater and, you know, had a moderate success with him. And
well, at the time, people thought roundly defeated.
Yeah, roundly, but still got a third of the vote and left an infrastructure, popular infrastructure of... He roused a lot of people who weren't discouraged by that round defeat. You know, there was always a right fringe, but the movement was getting less fringy, and Reagan was elected in California and became a national figure, increasingly popular, you know, almost got the nomination in 76. And the Powell memo was written in the late 60s by Lewis Powell, somewhere in the Justice Department, I think, under Nixon, wrote this very broad-gauge strategy memo for the resurgence of business dominance in the society, you know, foresaw all kinds of tactics that have since been adopted by various business lobbies, from defunding public media to increasing the dependence of both of education at all levels, from the university system to the primary school system, on business, advised increasing concentration of ownership in media, both electronic and print, and really, literally dozens of other fronts Powell proposed, on which the founding of think tanks to, you know, propose and diffuse illiberal policy proposals to state legislatures, and to feed local newspapers increasing amounts of, you know, copy in the form of these studies and reports from right-wing think tanks. And so the point is, they never really gave up. They never accepted the permanence of the legitimacy of the New Deal. And, you know, they, trial and error, given sufficient resources, will have its successes.
When I was a right-winger in the early 70s, though, we felt doomed, defending the last shreds of civilization against the onrushing barbarians. And it's hard to believe that one could have felt that when 10 years later Reagan was going to be inaugurated.
Well, it was, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that it wasn't a wave of new ideas or attitudes that swept over the population. It was rather the patient, gradual, well-funded building of an infrastructure of, you know, for the manufacture of consent. And it was, in time, you know, consciously coordinated by the Business Roundtable and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and industry associations, but these forms of persuasion and social control, public management, grew gradually, and in some ways they're the counterparts of what Ralph Nader was proposing in only the super rich can save us. That is a well-funded, grassroots campaign that doesn't quit and that finds, after many failures, its organic form and wins.
We should be so lucky. You review in this collection a book of Robert Dahl's, which I wasn't aware of. Not versed in the political science literature, but I always thought of Dahl pluralism. There were no hierarchies to speak of. It was all just different interest groups and such. And he had a change of heart. Tell us about his change of heart, which might not be so widely known.
Well, I don't know much about him personally, but he certainly did have a personal enlightenment of the kind of which not many political scientists have had. I mean, he really took the stuff seriously. He really took democracy seriously. And in the 50s, it was just very hard to... It was hard to be radically discontented with things as they were. I mean, of course, imaginative women were, and homosexuals were, but it wasn't so easy to see. The country wasn't a plutocracy to the same extent in the 50s. And so Dahl just busied himself with this outstanding empirical work and, became president of the American Political Science Association and wrote these widely acclaimed textbooks on how the American political system and political economy worked. And then, honorable man that he was, he gradually noticed that things weren't working so well. The foxes were being put, in charge of the hen coop, that money was reasserting its hegemony, its dominance. And he was both honorable enough and secure enough in his eminence to say so. And he rethought democratic ideology fairly radically and wrote two or three sterling books about, what was wrong with the direction American democracy was going. And what I remember best is that we read two of his books, but I think only one of them is collected. And it was the book on economic democracy. I forget the title.
A Preface to Economic Democracy.
Yeah. And the argument was that the distinction between the economy and the polity was artificial, and that the economy ought to be democratically governed, just as the polity should, and that essentially he extended the logic of democracy to the economy, as socialists have always been, is by my individual and idiosyncratic understanding of socialism, is what the term means, what the tradition has to offer. So he thought, without ever calling himself a socialist, as far as I know, he thought himself into democratic socialism, called it economic democracy, but in his 60s and 70s, never became...
That didn't attract quite the attention that the earlier work did.
Right, and he never mounted a pulpit. It was a very well-modulated conversion.
I'm speaking with George Shalaba, author of a collection of essays called For the Republic, published by Pressed Wafer Books. You work at Harvard as a not as an academic.
Clerical worker. Yeah.
Yes, but you're there during the reign of Larry Summers,
mm-hmm.
and the place is transformed from. I went to Yale, and I saw this happen there too. I mean, it transformed from this kind of genteel finishing school for the upper classes into an important node of the plutocracy.
Yes.
What does it look like up close now at Harvard?
As everywhere, it's becoming top-heavy with administrators, highly paid administrators, more and more of whom have no academic background. They've just come in to rationalize the administrative process.
Toward what end do we know?
Toward the bottom line. The development office is just ballooned at Harvard. That is to say, the office.
Because it's not rich enough already.
Right. Yes, never enough. And they're selling, everything. They're selling naming rights to individual seminar rooms. There's a whole office, there always has been an office, but it too has ballooned, the office of, governmental liaison or governmental affairs, whatever, to bring in research money. And there's, it's, if I may plug the Baffler, there's an essay forthcoming in the Baffler about how Harvard and MIT are now founding whole new sort of divisions to spot young entrepreneurs in their, among their science and engineering graduate students and partner with them and faculty members, give them seed capital or academic resources to develop their ideas into commercially exploitable form and own and share ownership of them. Larry Summers' mission at Harvard was to launch an enormous new science complex just across the river, the Charles River, across from where the business school is, in Alston. And this was going to be a great deal of what happened there, this entrepreneurial science. And he was, you know, the Board of Governors thought he was the ideal person to do it. He had a Wall Street sort of connection. On the other hand, he was a distinguished economist, you know, former chief economist of the World Bank. And
he had it all. He had the political connections, the academic prestige, and the Wall Street connections. A true Renaissance man.
Yeah, except that he had very little appreciation of non-quantitative intellectual efforts or culture. I mean, plenty of lip service, but, you know, but he would call humanities professors or even chairs in to say, you know, are you really pulling your weight?
How can we make money off of
right. I'm sure he didn't put it that way. And then, of course, the other reason he was hired was to help Harvard manage its portfolio. He hired a management team which very aggressively invested in, you know, the latest whiz bang financial products. And as a result, in 2007, the Harvard endowment lost one-third of its value. It went from $36 billion to $24 billion in a few months.
$24 billion would be the envy of any other institution in the world, but for Harvard, they felt poor.
Yes, they did, and they passed along the pain to the everyone except the administrators, who were the new administrators, who were taken on to make Harvard even leaner and meaner. But anyway, that plus, I mean, the unsuccessful investment strategy, plus his really atrocious sort of manners and just lack of charm was the end of Summers. But of course, he fell upward. And well, actually, what really pushed him out the door was the scandal of the Harvard crew that went over to oversee the Russian rapid conversion to, what was it called? Shock therapy.
Shock.
In Russia, yeah.
The Harvard Institute for International Development.
Yeah, exactly. They not only, you know, turned Russia into a plutocracy or accelerated the process, but a few of them capitalized on insider information and got rich, and one of them was his protege in the economics department.
Andre Schleifer.
Yes,
yeah.
Whom he refused to discipline, basically. I mean, the whole thing was a mess. I'm sure there's much more to it than I know about, but the faculty and the Board of Governors knew all about it, and, you know, even if he hadn't trodden on so many toes and made those, you know, tactless statements about women's innate capacities for, or lack of capacity for science, and hadn't told Cornell West that, you know, he needed to report to him every year or so on whether he was doing real scholarship or not, and not just whatever nonsense he was up to in Summers' eyes. The critical mass just got too powerful. But, of course, the ethos that brought him, that predated him, and that he reinforced when he was there is still there. So, you know, the strategy is still to hire academic superstars and to devolve as much teaching as possible onto graduate students or non-tenure track faculty. But still, it's getting more and more corporate all the time.
Well, this is a good pivot for my final question. That surviving ethos, you know, we had this enormous financial crisis, the worst recession in 80 years, a miserable recovery from that feels a little different from recession for many people. And yet our politics, you know, they still seem ossified in the old way of doing things. Is there any hope for the democratic vistas?
Well, you know, that reservoir of populist indignation and solidarity that existed after the defeat of populism and the defeat of the Socialist Party and its, you know, the conscious decimation of it on the pretext of homeland security in the during the First World War and in the early 20s by that bastard Woodrow Wilson, that hasn't refilled that reservoir, or the, you know, the flame hasn't rekindled. The unions in the 50s were fat and happy and didn't press for national health care or guaranteed income or any of the things that labor might have had the clout to, any of the structural, you know, really radical reforms that labor might have been able to press for. So those ideas had no purchase. And the right-wing counterattack, both ideological and economic, has been overwhelmingly successful. The society is much more atomized, much more fragmented and stultified, I'd say, than it was in the 30s and 20s. So I don't know, what can an old man do but hope? You know, there are green shoots everywhere. The Baffler and Jacobin and Dissent has a whole new staff of young editors that are full of enthusiasm. And of course, the gay and feminist movements, you know, to some extent, people will just, some of those people will take those gains and just get on with their careers. But some of them no doubt acquired a taste or a thirst for justice to be, that will apply in other spheres. Now that they won their rights, they won't rest content with it, but will think about other people's rights now that they have breathing space, workers and immigrants. And so no predictions, but no despair either. What would be the point of despairing? So although I'm by no means hanging up the cleats, as I mentioned before we started interviewing, I'm hoping to mount an all-out assault on evil in the form of Darth Krauthammer shortly. But on the whole, I feel my work is done, and I can read some of those thousands of novels and history books that I've been collecting from the excellent youth bookstores in Cambridge over the decades, and, you know, maybe know something before I totter off into the sunset.
That was George Shalaba, author of a collection of very fine political essays called For the Republic, published in May by Pressed Wafer. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the conclusion of the first movement of Haydn's Piano Sonata No. 43, performed by Jeno Jandó, and I'm sure that's not how you pronounce it in Hungarian, so sorry. Till next week, bye.